Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Perched high on the ledge of rock, the artist looked down from her vantage point. The valley stretched out ahead of her, lush vegetation surrounding the river running through its middle, yellow-brown hills flanking the corridor of green with a ribbon of blue at its heart. Her encampment sat just below her ledge, close enough that she could smell the fresh-caught fish cooking over the hearths and hear the sound of conversation. The clacking of stone on stone told her that somebody, out of sight around a corner of the rocky outcropping, was napping new stone tools. A vague scraping sound meant that someone was preparing a hide. That grinding noise came from people hard at work grinding up grass seeds. But she had a different task. Next to her, balanced precariously on the rock ledge, were two flat stones, one with a dab of red paint on top, the other white. Above her, as high as her arm could reach, the rock wall was covered with images. There was a Barbary sheep with great white curling horns. Next to it was a herd of elephants, and beside them a giraffe. A horizontal series of human figures, drawn in red paint, danced and twisted their way down a long row. The artist was proud of them. Looking down at the river, she saw a splash. A hippopotamus, she thought, and reached down for her paints. The artist's people were newcomers to these lands. A few centuries before, this lush and welcoming landscape hadn't existed. The canyon below where the river flowed had been a dry wadi, the hills featureless brown, the plant and animal life absent. Her ancestors had lived a long way to the north, near the sea, but that was an increasingly distant memory. Now, the rains had come and the desert bloomed. This was their home, the Green Sahara. 12,000 years ago, the Sahara Desert was much as it is today. Dry, desiccated, hostile to life of all stripes, perhaps even more so than it is now in the 21st century. Nobody lived there. 2,000 years after that, however, the Sahara teemed with life. Ancient ravines turned into rivers, empty basins became massive lakes, and vast grasslands spread out over what had once been dry sands. Elephants, buffalo, wild cattle, giraffes, hippopotamus, and people all made their homes in a brand new ecoregion. For thousands of years, the Green Sahara became a corridor uniting huge swaths of Africa, forever transforming the continent's cultures, populations, and ways of life. And I'm sure you've heard this from me before, but in case you haven't, I wrote a book. It's called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. The Verge is out now, and you can order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook from your distributor of choice. I'd really appreciate it. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The idea of Africa as humanity's cradle holds a great deal of truth. It was almost certainly where the earliest members of the genus Homo emerged a couple of million years ago. It's where we find the earliest anatomically modern humans several hundred thousand years ago, the people who recognizably look like us today and who are almost certainly our direct ancestors. Africa was the point of origin for the most recent global migration sometime before 100,000 years ago, from which all non-Africans across the world are ultimately descended. We are ultimately Africans, as the saying goes, and Africa has shaped our species in uncountable ways over the ages. Yet this concept of Africa as humanity's cradle carries numerous pitfalls as well. A cradle, by its nature, is something that people leave as they grow into adolescence and adulthood. Growing up requires us to leave the cradle. The cradle doesn't evolve with its former occupant, it stays the same, an unchanging reminder of that distant past and where we've come from. Anybody who stayed in the cradle, by contrast, might be unfairly painted with an infantilizing brush. Why didn't they leave and grow? Why did they stay behind? Consciously and unconsciously, we're heirs to a variety of ways of thinking about Africa that have had extremely damaging effects. Ideologies that justified slavery and exploitative colonialism live on in paternalistic and condescending strains of thought that characterize Africa as a place stuck at an earlier stage of social and cultural evolution. like indigenous Americans and foragers or small-time cultivators living on the fringes of state societies, the people of Africa have often been treated as if they have no history, like they're representatives of some original state of humankind. When we start to unpack this image and this set of ideas that go along with it, its shortcomings become obvious. Africa is not a cradle. And on top of that, these ideas, like the strong version of the cradle metaphor, blind us to the complexities of Africa's actual history. The people who live there now are not prisoners of a distant age. They're not passed over by the ebb and flow of events that happened elsewhere. Africa has its own history, or rather, many histories. Nor is it a singular place, but many different places, shifting over time in response to climatic changes and human interventions. Nor was Africa, like the cradle, simply left behind. People moved in and out of Africa and between its various parts in huge numbers over the past 20,000 years and more. These are basic points, so forgive me for harping on them, but it's necessary to address and rid ourselves of these lingering misconceptions in order to grasp Africa's many histories. Time didn't stop there. Things were never static. As we discussed last time, the groups that were ancestral to Homo sapiens lived all over the continent. They were in more or less continuous contact of all kinds with archaic humans living outside of Africa. Technologies and genes flowed in a variety of directions on a number of different timescales. Even now, Africa does retain deep splits in its population structure that reflect the many hundreds of thousands of years of human occupation. There's more genetic diversity within Africa than outside it, but these splits shouldn't be taken as evidence of an unchanging landscape of genetic ancestry or its ways of life. Today, we're going to move ahead in time. We're going to explore a whole sequence of remarkable cultures from the last glacial maximum to the Neolithic. Migrations brought several different waves of newcomers to different parts of Africa, some of whom brought farming and herding techniques from the Near East. Food production was invented at several different times and places within Africa. Populations associated with these new ways of life, agriculture and especially pastoralism, exploded in numbers, spreading out from their points of origin and both mixing with and burying the foragers who had previously lived there. As in Africa, Eurasia, and to a lesser extent the Americas, food production has dramatically altered the genetic and cultural landscape of Africa. And that's more or less what we'll discuss today. Let's begin around 15,000 years ago, in a cave in what's now eastern Morocco. This cave, called Tafaralt and also known as La Grotte des Pigeons, would have been a bustling place. People lived there year-round, making fires with the pine wood they found nearby to cook aurochs, wild cattle, antelope, and huge numbers of land mollusks, or snails. They carried pine nuts and acorns in baskets and prepared them to eat with grindstones. Their tools, single-edged stone blades and microliths, along with razor-sharp bone points, belonged to an industry known as Ibero-Maurusian, which had deep roots across North Africa over the preceding 10,000 years. They buried their dead in the cave, sometimes defleshing the bones and covering them in red ochre, occasionally returning to the caves to reconnect with the remains of their ancestors. In fact, Tafaralt is one of the earliest cemeteries ever found, and it's quite large, with 28 separate burials of multiple people. And the people of Tafaralt would have been instantly identifiable. Many of them had intentionally removed their upper incisors, the chisel-like front teeth, during their lifetimes. Ancient DNA analysis, published in a 2018 paper led by Marika van de Loestrecht, tells us even more about who these people were. The results were striking. Most of the ancestry of Tafaralt's people, more than 60% of it, tied them to the Natufian hunter-gatherers of the Near East, residents of today's Israel, Jordan, and Syria. The Natufians, if you remember, were among the first hunter-gatherers in the Fertile Crescent to begin experimenting with sedentary living and the grasses that eventually became domesticated wheat and barley. Yet the Levant is 2,500 miles, 4,000 kilometers away from Tafaralt. How do we explain this, and what does it tell us about these ancient people and their world? So first, it's certain that the Natufians were not descended from the people of Tafaralt. The Tafaralt people have two additional sources of ancestry, the remaining 40% that the Natufians don't have. But we can say that both of these groups, the Natufians and the people of Tafaralt, were descended from a common ancestral population that existed sometime before about 25,000 years ago. Where? Well, the best candidates are either the Near East in general, and more specifically the Levant, where the Natufians later lived, or the more eastern reaches of North Africa, especially the sections of the Nile in today's Egypt. The direct ancestors of the Tafaralt people moved west, probably along the southern coast of the Mediterranean until they eventually reached what's now Morocco and the welcoming environs of Tafaralt. Scholars have long pointed out the technological similarities between the Ibero-Maurusian tool industry found at places like Tafaralt and the Upper Paleolithic styles of the Levant before. This seems to confirm a more or less Eastern origin. It's fascinating, though, because it means that it didn't take the invention of farming in the Fertile Crescent for this Near Eastern type of ancestry to become common in North Africa. It wasn't a migration of Neolithic agriculturalists that remade the population structure of North Africa, maybe 8,000 years ago. The ties between the regions and their shared roots went back deep into the Paleolithic, at least 15,000 years ago, and probably much longer than that. The other 40% of the Tafaralt people's ancestry, the part unrelated to the Natufians, is even more revealing. This 40% contains two other distinct components. One is related to foraging groups living in East Africa today, like the Hadza of Tanzania, and the other to West Africans. These two ancestries, East African foragers and West Africans, are distinct from one another and belong to two much different populations. As the Tafaralt people's ancestors made their way west, then, they encountered other groups of people with their own deep histories, interbred with them, and continued onward. The Tafaralt people and early Neolithic North Africans living 7,000 years later had a much greater proportion of ancestry from sub-Saharan Africa than do later people living in North Africa, either today or in the past few thousand years. This is a good reminder that we can't simply reconstruct the populations of the deep past from the ancestry of people living today. Things change. Africa was never isolated from the world beyond, and the groups of people living within Africa could and did move quite significant distances. Those patterns of movement and interaction changed dramatically over time, and so did the ancestry and lifeways of the people living there. The DNA of the Tafaralt people and other samples of ancient DNA from Africa tell us about just how much has changed. I mentioned that the Tafaralt people derive a substantial chunk of their ancestry from groups related to foragers living in East Africa today, like the Hadza of Tanzania. But that distinctive ancestry was once much more widespread in Africa than it is today. A 2015 paper led by Marcos Gallego Llorente sampled the DNA of a 4,500-year-old individual buried at Mota Cave in the southern highlands of Ethiopia. Another paper the next year, led by Pontus Skoglund, added another dozen individuals of varying ages. What they found was a cline of related ancestry among ancient foragers stretching from East Africa all the way to South Africa, where the Khoisan, the most deeply diverged group of people alive today, currently live. Basically, the groups that lived closer together interacted with each other and exchanged mates in a way that more or less matched their distance from one another. This was a deeply rooted pattern that presumably developed over many, many thousands of years. But over the course of the past 3,000 or so years, give or take, much of that hunter-gatherer ancestry in East Africa has ceased to exist. The genetic signal has simply been swamped by a different type of ancestry, one strongly associated with expanding groups of farmers and especially pastoralists. The Tafaralt people, on their journey across North Africa, encountered one of these now lost groups of foragers, preserving that signal of ancestry in their DNA. A variety of old and extremely old samples show us a genetic landscape that simply no longer exists. No less than Europe, East Asia, and other regions where agriculture came to predominate, there has been a wholesale turnover of population structure. And in fact, not one, but at least two and probably more at different points in the last 3,000 years. Agriculture was independently invented in Africa in at least two places and perhaps more. Techniques of food production and domesticated plants and animals also made their way into Africa from the Near East and elsewhere, where migrants and established groups adapted them for their own purposes. Now, thanks to ancient DNA and an increasingly visible archaeological record, we can begin to trace those processes in greater detail. But before we get to Africa and its several Neolithics, in which groups of people expanded with their new suites of plants and animals, changing environments to better suit their needs and upending the demographic map, we have to remember that people aren't the only things that change. Environments change too, and people are shaped by those changes. Outside of the stunning glacial retreat from North America and Northern Europe, nowhere on Earth has changed more in the last 12,000 or so years than Africa. The Sahara Desert is the largest on the planet, a near-impassable expanse of dunes and rock that's often devoid of water. But this was not always the case. The Sahara has expanded and contracted many times, sometimes growing larger than it is now, at other points shrinking or disappearing entirely as it transformed into something much more like the massive savannas of East Africa. This is what happened as warmer, wetter conditions began to prevail in the Holocene. Dry riverbeds and snaking wadis filled with water, lakes grew in empty basins, and the Sahara became green. And as it became green, it filled with animals and plant life. People inevitably followed, setting in motion the processes that led to Africa's Neolithics and those massive shifts in population structure.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Around 10,000 years ago, a group of foragers came to a tall wall of rock in the Acacus Mountains of what is now the Central Sahara of Libya. From under the overhanging lip of a handy rock shelter, these hunter-gatherers looked out onto a lush savanna landscape, with occasional trees scattered around the grassland and rock formations. There were abundant fish in streams and rivers that provided the vast majority of their diet, but they also ate hares, Barbary sheep, toads, and even one unfortunate pelican. The Tucker Quarry Rock Shelter was a good place to stop and stay a while in a welcoming landscape, the increasingly green Sahara. People kept coming to Tucker Quarry for thousands of years, hunting and fishing and eventually bringing their domesticated cattle, sheep, and goats, until finally it grew too dry and desolate to support their lives. Today, massive dunes are visible from the opening of the rock shelter, and it's hard to imagine the aquatic riches and plant life that made the Acacus Mountains such an inviting place for foragers to live 10,000 years ago. The Green Sahara, in technical terms, the African Humid Period, wasn't a brief blip in time. It lasted for around 7,000 years, longer than the period that separates us today from the Green Sahara's end. Nor was this the first or only time that the Sahara had transformed into something more like a vast Serengeti than a desiccated expanse of rock and sand. The pattern has repeated itself over and over, leaving behind abundant evidence of running water, lakes, grasslands, and the animals that live there. In fact, the oscillations in climate that produce these fluctuations in the Sahara are among the major driving forces in all of human history, stretching back hundreds of thousands or even millions of years. Past migrations of Homo sapiens and archaic humans, splits in African population structures, the distributions of language families. All of these things have been deeply shaped by the Sahara's wet and dry phases in ways that we're only now starting to unravel. This latest Green Sahara, the African Humid Period, is simply closer to us in time. Much about the African Humid Period remains hazy, from the specific mechanics behind it to its timing to the role humans may have played in delaying or hastening its end. Nor are scholars fully agreed on the role of this lost environment in shaping the movements of groups of people, archaeological cultures, languages, and everything else that goes along with them. It's very much a new and evolving field, so even more than usual, please be aware that what I'm writing here can and will change, presumably in the very near future. But for now, here's more or less what we know. The major shifts associated with the Green Sahara began around 11,700 years ago, though in some regions they started a few thousand years earlier than that. The period had come to an end by 4,200 years ago, the 4.2 kiloyear aridification event that we've talked about before in Mesopotamia and the Indus Valley. Though, again, it was a long process and there was a great deal of regional variability. Parts of the Sahara had grown much drier long before then, forcing adaptations or migrations among their inhabitants. A note here, on the climate science of the Green Sahara, I'm relying on a review article entitled Theory and Modeling of the African Humid Period by Martin Clausen, Ann Dahlmeier, and Jürgen Bader. The root causes of the African Humid Period were global in scope. The basic mechanism was orbital forcing, essentially changes in the planet's orbit that affect the length of the seasons and the strength of sunlight within those seasons. Orbital forcing, in turn, has a massive effect on the global monsoon system, shifting the patterns of seasonal rainfall that produce the tropical belts wrapping themselves around the equator. But orbital forcing is only a trigger, it's not the sole cause. If it were solely responsible, we would see Green Sahara events like clockwork every 20,000 years over the past 8 million years. We don't see them with that kind of regularity, which tells us that there's something more complicated at work. That more complicated thing is the relationship between orbital forcing, ocean temperatures, atmospheric circulation, and the land itself, with soil moisture and albedo, meaning how much solar energy the land absorbs or reflects, which varies based on the kind of vegetation it has. If you want to get real fancy with it, you can also include dust in the atmosphere, which affects the formation of clouds and thus precipitation. Then, to make it even more complicated, we have to account for the fact that the relationship between climatic systems and vegetation, the green part of the Green Sahara, isn't completely direct. It's probably not surprising to hear that this is a really, really difficult relationship to model. Some models come closer than others to predicting the actual kinds of landscapes we see in the Holocene Green Sahara, but none has yet fully explained how and why the African Humid Period functioned precisely how it did. The upshot of all of these extremely complex models and mechanisms is that the Sahara became much more humid and wetter, and that across much of the region, this happened pretty quickly. Within a few centuries, a much more rapid timescale than we would assume from an orbital forcing mechanism alone. More and more rain fell further and further north, probably more pronounced at first in the western reaches of the Sahara by 11,700 years ago, and then growing more noticeable in the east, in what's now Libya, after about 10,500 years ago. Those people who came to Takarkori rock shelter about 10,000 years ago were stepping into a whole environment that had only existed there for a brief period of time, just a few centuries at the most. They were newcomers, strangers in a strange land, people who were entering territory that had been quite literally uninhabitable for millennia until very recently. So what was that land like? The Green Sahara was actually a varied series of different landscapes, some of them greener than others. At least one part of the Sahara, the Great Sand Sea of eastern Libya and western Egypt, remained a desert even during the wettest parts of the African Humid Period. The mega dunes of this region were just too hostile to be transformed. Elsewhere, however, a shocking variety of plant and animal life took hold, all of it tied to the increasing availability of water. In the most striking cases, this literally did make the Sahara green, especially around the profusion of lakes that grew up in shallow basins. Some of these bodies of water were extremely large. A brand new, hot-off-the-presses study from January of 2022, led by Nick Drake of King's College London, confirms the existence of multiple megalakes across what's now the Sahara. The largest of them was Megalake Chad, which still exists today at the border of Niger, Nigeria, Cameroon, and Chad, albeit in much diminished form. This vast, shallow lake was 10 times as large as it is today during the African Humid Period. Other lakes included Lake Ptolemy in what's now western Sudan, Lake Megafezin in Libya, Chott's Megalake in southern Tunisia, Takarkori Lake near the rock shelter we talked about earlier, and many, many others. That recent paper I mentioned identified a brand new megalake called Megalake Timbuktu in what's now central Mali. Other basins and depressions filled up with smaller bodies of water or seasonal ones. River systems appeared all over the Sahara, some of them very large. The Tamanrasset River, flowing through the western Sahara from what's now Algeria to Mauritania, would have been truly enormous in scale among the great river valleys of the planet. At the other end of the spectrum, the dry wadis, the canyons that today crisscross the desert, flowed with water, sometimes seasonal, but sometimes perennial. The Nile had a whole additional tributary, in addition to the blue and white Niles, known as the Yellow Nile. It ran through what's today called the Wadi Howar, flowing through Chad and western Sudan, to meet the main channel at the Great Bend in northern Sudan. Near the rivers and lakes, galley forests and green grasslands grew up, a wonderfully welcoming environment for plant and animal life. Giraffes, elephants, hippopotamus, aurochs, herds of grazers, lions, crocodiles, a stunning abundance of fauna, making the most of their new home precisely as the people were. Even outside these corridors, the landscape would have been yellow and brown, filled with grass and more marginal plant life, still viable if not exactly like the Garden of Eden. We have to imagine that those environments, outside the sources of water, would have been more vulnerable to disruption, and more seasonally used by the people who made their homes in the Green Sahara. The rivers and lakes were the lifeline. They offered a roadmap through which the region's inhabitants could spread out into this newly viable landscape. Some of them may have been fully aquatic people. One of the oldest boats ever found, the Defuna Canoe, is about 8,000 years old. It was found in an area that would have been really near Mega Lake Chad at the time. Ironically, the Nile Valley may have been an exception. People were thick on the ground there in the millennia leading up to the Holocene, to the extent that we see evidence for vicious intergroup conflict in archaeological sites from the period, presumably driven by population pressure and environmental scarcity. At Jebel Sahaba, on the present-day border between Egypt and Sudan, 38 of the 61 skeletons in the cemetery show evidence for violent trauma. But with the Sahara growing more welcoming, foragers living along the Nile could simply follow the wadis out into the fresh grassland and river systems. There was probably a push dimension to this, too. The patterns of rainfall that made the Sahara greener also made the Nile's annual floods much more forceful and dangerous. They drenched the White and Blue Nile tributaries with rains upstream and led to devastating and unpredictable flooding downstream, forcing people away from the river for at least part of the year. So, for the people living on what had been the margins of the desert, the result was an incredible set of opportunities, one that's rarely been matched in human history. The foragers who came to Takakori Rock Shelter were among the first, but hardly the last, to take advantage of what this new landscape had to offer. When I mentioned earlier that Africa underwent enormous shifts in its population structure in fairly recent times, the Green Sahara was a necessary prerequisite. It was only thanks to the opening of these new environments to exploit, new corridors through which to move, and new possibilities of subsistence and expansion that such huge changes could have taken place. This wetter environment brought people together, linking groups living all across this vast region. It was only at the beginning of the African humid period that the Middle Stone Age toolmaking tradition, dating back tens of thousands of years in West Africa to the days of archaic Homo sapiens, finally came to an end. That was surely a product of people going on the move in a new climatic age, bringing new ideas and new ways of doing things with them in response to a new environment. And when the African humid period eventually came to an end, that too produced a massive push factor that set groups of people on the move, heading in all directions for what were quite literally greener pastures. There's no understanding the distribution of pastoral and farming lifestyles and certain kinds of genetic ancestry within Africa today without taking into account the Green Sahara.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
When the Sahara suddenly became a more welcoming place to live after around 11,700 years ago, it presented an absolutely open set of landscapes. With a couple of exceptions, like the Nile Valley and the fluctuating environs of Lake Chad, the whole region was essentially uninhabited and had been for thousands of years. It was simply too dry, too hostile, too unwelcoming to any way of life then devised by even the cleverest hunter-gatherers. But as the African humid period took hold and the Sahara grew wetter and more viable, people expanded into this new niche. Given the conditions, it's safe to assume that their expansion was rapid and that populations soared in relatively brief periods of time. This was a huge and inviting new area, roughly the size of the continental United States, that in the blink of an eye opened to human occupation. Takakori Rock Shelter in the Central Sahara was occupied around 10,000 years ago. Almost simultaneously, large numbers of sites appear in Egypt's western desert in the east. A couple of centuries later, a series of sites appeared in northern Niger, hundreds of miles to the south of Takakori. By around 8,000 years ago, the intensely wet environments of the southwestern Sahara and today's Mali were densely populated. Now, the ancestry of the Sahara's new inhabitants and their origins isn't entirely clear. At least some were descended from people like those of Tafaralt, that 15,000-year-old site in eastern Morocco that we discussed back at the very beginning. Whether they came from Morocco or from related populations living in the Maghreb along the Mediterranean coast is hard to say. Others certainly expanded west from the Nile Valley. The archaeological evidence, especially in the form of adaptable, innovative, microlithic toolmaking traditions, is unequivocal. The routes are obvious, too. People simply followed the wadis, now flowing with at least seasonal rivers, out into what had until recently been the desert. Whether there were additional sources of ancestry, like groups of people living along the southern fringes of the Sahel, the region between tropical Africa and the Sahara, or near the variable lakes, is harder to say. The answer is almost certainly yes, there were other groups moving into the new Sahara, most likely from the south, what's now Ethiopia and South Sudan. We're still waiting on ancient DNA studies to give us more precise insight, and that'll probably happen in the next couple of years. For now, though, we can look at the material remains and come up with a reasonable explanation. Everything we see speaks to rapid expansion, probably of relatively small initial groups. The microlithic toolkits, small chipped stone blades mounted on wood or bone hafts, are remarkably similar across the whole region. Even more striking, the newly green Sahara became home to one of the world's earliest independent traditions of pottery making. The oldest currently dated examples of this tradition come from Niger and are almost 10,000 years old. They fall into two types, and all of them were richly decorated prior to firing. The preferred form of decoration was, again, remarkably similar across this whole region. A series of comb impressions were occasionally a cord, less often incisions, that left patterns of straight and wavy lines of dots across the surface of the vessels. It's called, naturally enough, the dotted wavy line tradition. Again, it's hard to tell whether we're looking at a single dominant diffusion of people and lifeways, probably from the Nile Valley, or multiple groups from different places. But either way, it's obvious that shared cultural traits came to dominate all across the region. That dotted wavy line tradition spread all over the place, with the decorated pottery probably serving as prestige goods, maybe things exchanged as gifts between groups. With such an abundance of waterways, movement by boat across the Green Sahara could have been quite rapid. So, whether we're talking about groups with different origins coalescing around similar lifeways and cultural traits, or a more limited ancestral population diffusing outward and then staying in contact over time and space, the key point is really the connectivity of the landscape. It was relatively easy across a wide region for groups of people to stay in touch, trade, exchange mates, and share in a distinct cultural tradition. While the Green Sahara's inhabitants had pottery, they, unlike the pottery-using peoples of the Fertile Crescent at that time, were not farmers, and they would not become so for a very long time. Instead, they remained foragers. Now, that doesn't mean they were simple, far from it. The logic was just straightforward. In an environment that offered such an abundance of animal, plant, and aquatic life, why would you transition to food production? Simply wasn't necessary. The people living at Takakori Rock Shelter in the Central Sahara ate a wide variety of things, from aurochs to fish. Wild-growing millet and other plants were also viable sources of food. The remains of wild cereals have been found in many early Holocene sites across the Sahara. This was another shared cultural pattern. In the drier parts of the Atlas Mountains, hunting was the focus, especially Barbary sheep, which were found in large numbers in the higher altitudes. In the lower, wetter environments in the southern Sahara, like Niger and Chad, there was more explicit reliance on aquatic resources. Along lakeshores and riverbanks, and in the extensive seasonal floodplains and wetlands surrounding them, specialized fisherfolk made their living by harvesting fish and other prey from the abundant landscape. But again, regardless of ancestry, which we're still unsure of, and specialized subsistence strategy, even language, we should assume a certain degree of cultural homogeneity and, again, contact between groups. Sedentary and semi-sedentary living was common across the Sahel and the Sahara, even in the absence of domesticated crops and animals. But a well-watered grassland was also a prime environment for a specific kind of food production. Not domesticating and farming plant foods, but pastoralism. The earliest Neolithic in Africa didn't involve wheat or millet, but instead livestock, namely goats, sheep, and cattle. In fact, this earliest African Neolithic derives its name from this distinct path to food production. It's called the pastoral Neolithic, and it represents a totally different way of adopting a food-producing way of life than we see in the Near East, in China, or in any other center of agricultural domestication. On no other continent was there such a long gap between the adoption of domestic animals and domesticated plants. This pastoral Neolithic was an original response to the ecological and cultural circumstances of this specific region, in much the same way that the peoples of the Eurasian steppe adopted nomadic herding as their new way of life around 4000 BC. Barbary sheep are native to Africa, and there's evidence for foragers corralling and selectively culling them in Libya as early as 8500 years ago. They were never domesticated, though. Sheep and goats, by contrast, aren't native to Africa. They were introduced to the region from the Near East, starting around 6000 BC. The earliest evidence of them has been tentatively dated to 7800 years ago at the site of Nabta Playa, west of the Nile in the Nubian Desert. Wild aurochs were found throughout North Africa. A number of scholars have argued for the independent domestication of cattle in the region at a shockingly early date at a site called Bir Keseiba near Nabta Playa, but that's based on extremely thin evidence and I don't think it's correct. Neither does the majority of the scholars working on the topic, as far as I can tell. There is every reason to think that cattle, like sheep and goats, were an import from the Near East. Again, this is part of the overarching point of the last two episodes. Africa was never isolated from the rest of the world. But there's no especially good evidence for a mass migration of people from the Near East along with the livestock. This was not a colonization, though it's probable that some migrants and therefore gene flow made their way southwest into Africa. Instead, what seems to have happened is that the domesticated sheep, goats, and a little bit later cattle made their way into the hands of the foragers who were already living in this broad Sahara region. For example, the people living at the 7,000-year-old Neolithic site of Ifri Namir Umusa in central Morocco were descended from the people living at Tafaral some 8,000 years before, not too far away. And, as with the foragers themselves when the landscape opened up, there's every reason to think that domesticated animals spread across the Sahara with remarkable speed. By 7,000 years ago, 5000 BC, just 800 years after the first documented evidence of them, they had spread everywhere from the hills between the Nile and the Red Sea, the eastern desert, as far as the mountains of the central Sahara. Within a few more centuries, by about 6500 BC, domesticated animals were present in Algeria, southern Sudan, and the fringes of the Niger River. Rather than the wholesale replacement of the existing people in the Green Sahara by newcomers or the mass adoption of a new way of life, what we see is the incorporation of domesticated animals into existing societies. Basically, they stayed foragers but added some domesticated animals to their package. But still, the rapidity of this spread might have had something to do with the climate. Right around this time, the Sahara was drying out, it was growing more arid. Foragers, looking for a more reliable source of food, or maybe a cosmological hedge against the fear of the unknown, had good reasons to try this new technique of food production, of what's called delayed return. So, in addition to acting as a brand new ecological region into which people spread at the beginning of the Holocene, the Green Sahara was also home to the creation of a new pastoralist way of life, a pastiche of imported animals and existing traditions. From this home base, the pastoral Neolithic spread far and wide, but not right away. A 2019 ancient DNA study led by the archaeologist Mary Prendergast, whom you'll hear me interview next week, shed some light on the ancestry of this newly widespread group of pastoralists. They termed them early Northeastern African pastoralists. There were two major components to their ancestry in roughly equal proportions. The first, like that of the Tafaralt people in Morocco 15,000 years ago, was related to that of the Natufian hunter-gatherers of the Levant. This doesn't necessarily imply a migration of early farmers with this ancestry. As we discussed earlier, this ancestral component could have been present within Africa, maybe in the Horn, maybe in the Maghreb, maybe elsewhere, for thousands of years. The second component is related to present-day Dinka and Nuer people living in Ethiopia and South Sudan. In other words, it's precisely the kind of population you would expect to come into existence if two distinct groups of foragers moved into the Green Sahara, lived there for a while and came together, and then adopted a pastoral way of life that made them exceptionally successful. The end of the African humid period and the Green Sahara was a rapid but not overnight event. Conditions grew steadily drier between 7,000 and 6,000 years ago, precisely the period when the pastoral way of life spread out across the region. It was only around 5,500 years ago, around 3,500 BC, that the point of no return had been reached. The mechanisms, as with the beginnings of the African humid period, are unclear and much debated. A 2017 paper led by James Collins argues for atmospheric cooling at higher latitudes, which weakened the atmospheric stream, the tropical easterly jet, that had produced greater rainfall across the Sahara. This may have been combined with longer and slower shifts in insolation. But based on the speed of the environmental collapse across large parts of this region, it only took a relatively small shift in those atmospheric patterns to tip the scales against the Green Sahara. That minor bump set off a feedback loop that brought increasing amounts of dust, shifts in the patterns of vegetation, and the loss of precipitation. In practical terms, for the people living in the Sahara, the result was an increasingly uninhabitable home. Rivers and lakes that they relied on for fish and water for their livestock dried up. The grasslands in which they hunted and grazed their animals disappeared, even as they worked hard to conserve their resources. One recent paper even suggests that innovative grazing practices may have maintained increasingly fragile Saharan environments for centuries longer than the shifting climate data alone would suggest. But despite their efforts, things did change. The abundant wild grasses they had collected and processed for food were gone. This wasn't the same everywhere. The more diverse the vegetation, it seems, the longer an area remained viable for human habitation. The more groundwater that was available, the better off the people were. But everywhere, the trend was unmistakable. And this was what forced the people who had made their homes in the eastern reaches of the Green Sahara, with that distinctive early northeastern African pastoralist ancestry, to go elsewhere. Some of these people pushed to the southwest into present-day Niger, Mali, and Mauritania, and then even further into tropical West Africa. Others went east into the Nile Valley, where they had a profound impact on the development of the civilization we know as ancient Egypt. Others went north toward the coast, where they encountered more recent immigrants, farmers descended from the maritime migrants who had brought the Neolithic to the Mediterranean shores of Europe. But others went south, slowly but surely, and it was there that they left the most notable impact. By around 5,000 years ago, 3,000 BC, herders were living near Lake Turkana in what's now Kenya and southern Ethiopia. Quite rapidly after that, livestock spread through the whole Turkana Basin. Some of the people maintaining these livestock were migrants. Others were local hunter-gatherers who, like the ancestors of the pastoralists, had adapted livestock to their existing way of life. It was probably the Turkana Basin that served as the launching pad for the later expansion of this pastoral Neolithic southward after around 4,200 years ago. About 80% of this new group's ancestry derived from the early northeastern African pastoralists, while about 20% came from indigenous East African hunter-gatherers. This way of life expanded southward into Kenya, Tanzania, and Malawi, eventually reaching the most southerly reaches of Africa. And this was only one of the subsequent pulses of migration and change that transformed the population structure and cultural dynamics of Africa. Plants were domesticated in no fewer than two places, in the Horn of Africa, where the tuber enset, the cereal teff, and coffee were all native, and in the Sahel or Southern Sahara, where African rice and pearl millet were first brought under sustained cultivation. The most momentous of these changes, however, was the Bantu expansion, a massive millennia-long series of population movements beginning in West Africa that completely remade the linguistic, cultural, and genetic maps of the continent. This is a topic so large that it deserves not one but a whole series of episodes, and I hope I can cover it in the future. The combination of paleoclimate studies, ancient DNA, and good old-fashioned archaeology has transformed our understanding of Africa's ancient past. It was never isolated from the surrounding world, nor was it in any way backward, some window onto an unchanging past. Like everywhere else, Africa was constantly in flux. Its climate changed dramatically. New groups of people migrated, mixed, and came into existence. Innovative new lifeways developed to take advantage of shifting circumstances. These shifts have dramatically altered the cultural and population dynamics of Africa, leaving behind only the faintest traces of the groups that existed in the most ancient past. So far from being a window onto humanity's origins, Africa is representative of that most fundamentally human characteristic: mutability, change, and the constant motion that defines our shared history. Next time on Tides of History, we're going to shift gears a bit and talk about something different, a more conceptual set of questions. What exactly is a state? How do we study them? How do we see them in the textual and archaeological record? And how can we tell whether or not they even exist?
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I've also written a book called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, ebook, or audiobook that I read, of course, from your distributor of choice. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.